From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today we salute the centenary of a thinker known as a media visionary, a prophet of the information age, and the father of communications, Marshall McLuhan. Once you start looking, Marshall McLuhan is everywhere.
It's the influence of television. Yeah, now, Marshall McLuhan deals with it in terms of it being a high intensity, you understand? A hot medium.
What I wouldn't give for a large sock with horse manure in it. What do you do when you get stuck on a movie line with a guy like this behind you?
Wait a minute, why can't I give my opinion? This is a free country?
He can give you. You have to give it so loud. I mean, aren't you ashamed to pontificate like that? And the funny part of it is, Marshall McLuhan, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's work.
Really? I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan, well, have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So yeah, just let me come over here a second.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing. You know nothing of my work.
Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively opposed, put in opposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result.
That's DJ Spooky with his Marshall McLuhan remix. McLuhan was born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, on July 21, 1911. He died on December 31, 1980. McLuhan was one of the most famous intellectuals of his time, and one of the most prophetic. He predicted the internet almost 30 years before it was invented. As Tom Wolfe put it back in the early 60s, suppose he is what he sounds like, the most important thinker since Newton, Darwin, Freud, Einstein, and Pavlov. Suppose he is the oracle of the modern times. We'll meet two of McLuhan's former colleagues who've written books about his ideas, and McLuhan's fellow Canadian Douglas Copeland. We'll talk about the McLuhan-esque approach he took to writing the great man's biography. Also, we'll find out how McLuhan inspired David Cronenberg's 1983 sci-fi horror film, Videodrome. Paul Levinson just can't shake Marshall McLuhan. When Levinson was a PhD student at New York University during the 1970s, he had the opportunity to write a preface to McLuhan's article, The Laws of the Media. To Levinson's delight, McLuhan liked the preface, and it was included when the article was published in the Semantics Journal, etc. Levinson went on to write Digital McLuhan, a guide to the information millennium. Levinson has vivid memories of McLuhan.
He was a comet intellectually. I mean, it's trite to say that, but, you know, I've met a fair share of brilliant people. Karl Popper, the British philosopher, Isaac Asimov, in my view, a genius science fiction writer. But no one I've ever met had the intellectual fluorescence of McLuhan. He was constantly lit up, making connections. We would be walking in the street and a shiny new car would drive by and he'd say, you know, the automobile retrieves the knight in shining armor. That driver is wearing that just as the knight wore his armor in the Middle Ages. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say, what on earth could the connection be between a knight's armor and an automobile? But on the other hand, when you think about it, it makes sense. Yeah. I was fortunate. I heard a lot of McLuhan's aphorisms in person. In some cases, they hadn't been written yet. In other cases, they had been. And, for example, the medium is the message. This is one of the most famous of McLuhan's notions. By the way, misunderstood. McLuhan didn't mean that content is totally unimportant because without content, you wouldn't have a medium. What he meant is when you look at the content, bear in mind that the medium is shaping the content. But McLuhan had an enormous amount of fun with that. He titled a later book, The Medium is the Massage. And then he would just go on these endless things. Well, the tedium is the massage. The tedium is the message. The medium is the mass age.
You can almost see him smiling, can't you?
Absolutely.
But, you know, sometimes that drove people crazy. You laugh at it, and I understand. But as you point out in Digital McLuhan, he often said that he doesn't explain, and he didn't. He said, what's his famous saying, I don't explain, I explore?
Yes. And of course, as I point out in Digital McLuhan, that's something of an oxymoron or a self-refuting statement, because it is an explanation of McLuhan's method. So he did explain many times.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how many of the things that we now see as new and exciting, McLuhan saw coming. I mean, you write in New Media that Twitter is really simply an expansion of McLuhan's work.
Well, that's right. I mean, I couldn't help but notice that this 140-character limitation is strikingly similar to the way McLuhan, for example, entitled his small chapters in another one of his best-known works, The Gutenberg Galaxy, which is where he introduced the term the global village. Rather than having what we would expect as chapter titles, three or four words, he would have like a sentence. The sentence might be, you know, along the lines of, the new electronic interdependence is recreating the world into a global village.
So he was tweeting his chapters, huh?
Exactly right. And not only that, another, you know, connection from the past is the telegram, which was also a terse medium. There were economic reasons for it. People had to pay for every word. But this notion that somehow Twitter is something new under the sun in terms of the brevity of its communication, that's also just completely not the case.
So much to talk about McLuhan, but I think to understand any of it, we have to talk a little bit about what he called acoustic space. Can you explain that to me, please?
What he meant by that gets at the difference between seeing and hearing. Now, if you think about what seeing is, you have to look at what you're seeing, otherwise you don't see it. And if you turn your head, you see something very different. Furthermore, our connection to the visual world is very easily breakable. It's discontinuous. We can close our eyes, turn our head, do anything, and that changes literally what we're seeing. Now, in contrast, if you think about how we hear, we have no ear lids. There's no way we can easily shut sound off. You don't have to put your ear in the direction of the sound. I mean, maybe if it's a faint sound in the distance, but ordinarily sound approaches us on a 360-degree surround, and it comes from us from in front, from behind, from the sides, and all that works into the process. So we're continually in touch with our sounds. We're not continually in touch with our sights. McLuhan, realizing that, then made the brilliant leap that the electronic media world was an acoustic kind of space, not a visual space. And so people start saying, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? Don't you watch television? McLuhan said, yes, of course you watch television. But the point is, if there are televisions, if you walk, let's say, into a store or a sports bar and there are television screens on, they're coming at you from all directions. And furthermore, if you think about a community, if you think about a city, a nation, now a world, there are television screens that are on in all of these places, and they're all showing the same thing. So it turns out that what's on television, this is what McLuhan was most interested in when he was talking about acoustic space, is not something that can easily be shut off or disconnected, and not even something that you have to look at that's available only in one place, that it's increasingly becoming something that's everywhere.
There are also the laws of the media that McLuhan wrote. They're known as the tetrad, the four laws of the media.
Yes.
They are what?
McLuhan was always interested in the impact that media had on us and on each other. And at some point, very late in his career, he came up with this four-part schema. That was a word he liked to use, not a theory, you know, a probe, a schema, that basically explained the relationship of media both to us and each other. That is the relationship of one medium to another. And the way he put it was like this. Let's take radio as an example. There are four things that radio does, four kinds of impacts that radio has. The first is it enhances or amplifies something. What does radio enhance or amplify? Communication by sound, instant communication, mass communication, one message to many people. At the same time that radio enhances or amplifies something, it has a second impact. It obsolesces a medium that previously existed. So radio obsolesced all kinds of things. It obsolesced, for example, newspapers. Didn't put them out of business, but when radio began providing news instantly across large areas, it made the newspaper a lot less necessary. But there's also a third impact that new media have, that all new media and technologies have, because even as they amplify something and obsolesce an earlier medium, in their amplification or enhancement, they retrieve something, a mode of communication which had previously been obsolesced itself. And so what radio retrieves is spoken communication, which to some extent had been obsolesced by writing, written communication, newspapers. What radio retrieves is the town gossip as a mode of getting information, because you hear somebody talking on the radio just as you might hear a town gossip. And in some ways, the fourth feature of this is the most interesting and the most amenable to all kinds of speculation, because McLuhan said, in addition to these three impacts or processes, when a new medium is pushed to its limits, it flips into something which goes almost completely opposite to what the new medium did, but still carries a lot of characteristics. And he actually sometimes used the word flip, but he also like the word reversal. And so McLuhan said, radio amplifies instant communication by sound. It obsolesced the printed word, the visual. It retrieved spoken communication. When pushed to its limits, radio flipped or reversed into another visual medium, but not print, not writing. Radio reversed or flipped into television, which is radio, but with a visual component.
Of course, the other thing, as you write about in the book, that is exciting about that fourth law, the fourth part of the tetrad, is that it implies humans take an active role in this, that we're always pushing toward the limits of this media so that it has, I guess, the opportunity to flip.
That's right. And this gets back again to my doctoral dissertation and a point I used to make to McLuhan. Media don't evolve on their own. It's nice to talk about the evolution of media, and I do this all the time, but the cardinal difference between the evolution of living organisms and the evolution of media is that creationism is correct for the evolution of media. We're the deities when it comes to media evolution. We push the envelope. Our dissatisfaction with today's medium results in the invention of tomorrow's medium. So, you know, if you look at the iPhone and the BlackBerry and, you know, all of these devices, iPads, human beings, having appreciated the miracle of the internet, began to get frustrated because they could not have it whenever they wanted it. And this is human nature. We think about wanting to send an email to someone. We want to do it at that instant. We don't want to wait until we get to the office or drive home to send that email. And so it was that frustration that set the stage for the iPhone and the BlackBerry and all those media. It's the human stewardship of media that result in these flips into new media and into, well, what I would consider progress in the evolution of media.
Clearly, you're a great admirer of McLuhan, and you've spent years studying him. Are there things he got wrong?
Yeah, I think that he got one thing wrong in particular, and this is actually still a subject of debate. And what that was during the Vietnam War, McLuhan was constantly pressed to, well, come out against the war. I was certainly very much against the war in the 1960s, and a lot of McLuhan students were. And McLuhan's response to that was, you don't have to take a position against the war because the evolution of media are going to change the very nature of wars, and the wars will be fought through information not through physical bombing and stuff like that. So interestingly, a significant part of that has come true. That's what cyber attacks are all about, right? That's what hacking is all about. That's what denial of services. So McLuhan was completely right about that. But what he sadly was wrong about, as we well know, is physical wars have not been obsolesced. So here we are bombing Libya. We have troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And obviously, as advanced an information world as we are, it's not yet come to be where the new war is fought through information rather than physical bodies.
Paul Levinson is the author of Digital McLuhan, A Guide to the Information Millennium. He teaches communications and media studies at Fordham University.
When I say the medium is the message, I'm saying that the motor car is not a medium. The medium is the highway, the factories, and the oil companies. That is the medium. In other words, the medium of the car is the effects of the car. When you pull the effects away, the meaning of the car is gone. The car, as an engineering object, has nothing to do with these effects. The car is a figure in a ground of services. It's when you change the ground that you change the car. The car does not operate as the medium, but rather as one of the major effects of the medium. So what the medium is a message is not a simple remark, and I've always hesitated to explain it. It really means a hidden environment of services created by an innovation. And the hidden environment of services is the thing that changes people. It is the environment that changes people, not the technology.
What do you think of Marshall McLuhan and his ideas? Do you have a favorite McLuhanism? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our weekly Facebook page there. Coming up, we continue our celebration of Marshall McLuhan's life and work on the centenary of his birth. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
In the 1970s, Robert Logan taught a course called The Poetry of Physics at the University of Toronto. Through the course, Logan met Marshall McLuhan. The meeting was a watershed in Logan's life. Today, he is Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of Toronto and the author of Understanding New Media, Extending Marshall McLuhan. Logan told Anne Strainchamps about the first time they met.
Well, I was struck by his extraordinary understanding of my field of science and physics and his broad, well, his total knowledge of just about everything. But more impressive of all was the way in which he connected different things. We became fast friends because, being the kind of guy that I am, connecting poetry and physics, I was McLuhan's kind of guy. We worked together to the end of his life.
Well, I'm really fascinated by how predictive much of his work was. I mean, especially in terms of thinking about the media landscape, he practically predicted the internet, which, you know, certainly was not even a glimmer in anybody's eye yet.
He was introduced by Matt Hillock to six senior IBM officials. And at the lunch, he said that someday, this was in 1966, he said someday every family will have a computer and they won't have to go out to shop. They'll just be able to order things with their computer. After the lunch, the executive said to Matt Hillock, "That man, that Marshall McLuhan you brought, he's really crazy." And here McLuhan was predicting the arrival of the personal computer in early 1980s.
Oh, that's astonishing.
Yeah, I'll give you another example. He once said, "Someday we're going to have a device about the size of a hearing aid that will bring us information from all over the globe, and we'll have instant access to all the libraries of the world. So not only did he predict the internet, he predicted smartphones, he predicted Wikipedia, he predicted Google Books.
Wow.
The man was extraordinary.
And then there was his concept of the global village, which you should explain it to me, but it sounds to me awfully like Facebook.
Yes, it is. That's only one example. But even before Facebook, what he said was with electric information, where you're being bombarded by information from all sides, from every point on the globe, the things that you hear about through the media affect you as though they're happening in your own village. So most of us felt great sorrow for the people of Libya because of the oppression of Gaddafi. We were all rooting for the people in Tahrir Square when the Egyptians were fighting for their freedom. And the feelings we had were like this was happening, you know, two streets away from where I live. Mm-hmm. This was not some remote country. This was something we all cared about. That's something that was not true before we had TV. Think about how the Americans ducked World War I and World War II until they were finally driven into it. They didn't enter World War I until 1917, when it was almost over. They didn't enter World War II until they were bombed by the Japanese.
How was McLuhan able to be so insightful about the form our future media would take, do you think? I mean, did it have something to do with the fact that he had spent so much time looking at the medium rather than the content?
That's right, and the fact that he looked for effects rather than causes. He said, I never predicted anything about the future that didn't happen today. So what he did was he looked at the trends of his time and just used his imagination to extend their logical consequences.
Hmm.
And that's why he was able to, you know, achieve the insights that he did.
What do you think he'd be telling us about our media today? Because, you know, the media landscape has changed out of all recognition since he was here.
The first thing he would say would be, I told you so. Because everything he predicted, every description he made of mass electric media happens to be true for digital media, but even more so. So he talked about how electric media would decentralize. Well, nothing is more decentralized than the internet and the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
He told us that knowledge would become the main driver of the economy. He said this in the 60s. It wasn't until the 80s, maybe the 70s and 80s, the people like Toffler and others that talked about the knowledge economy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess he was a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Best way to describe it. And what's ironic is that he came under attack by his colleagues in academe. And to this day, there are still people that in academe that regard him as a charlatan.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't follow the rules as they do. What they do is they package information in nice little bundles with footnotes.
You've written recently, kind of extending his ideas into the digital media landscape today. As you look at the world we have now of the internet and smartphones and video games and Facebook, what message do you see inherent in the digital media that surrounds us?
Let me be like McLuhan and say, there's one thing McLuhan missed. He talked about how reading and writing would become obsolete with electric media.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what's happened is that literacy has regained its position in our lives because the web, texting, kids are using language all the time, written language. Now, they're changing the nature of the language. They have a different way of using written language. I imagine that Marshall right now would be LOL about this development, just to illustrate this idea, right? So that to me is one of the surprises of the digital age, is that literacy is making a great comeback. And with e-readers, e-books, people are reading even more than they did before the e-book arrived on the scene.
His work was so predictive of where we are today, but I wonder what you would say his continuing relevance or continuing value to us today is.
I think he, in some ways, created an environment that allowed today's developments to occur. I mean, some of the predictions he made was, he said, the new captains of industry, the people that would be able to exploit electric media, would be playful, not serious types. Hmm. And when you think about who created Facebook, who created Apple, they were all young kids that were having fun. They were hobbyists. They were just playing. Jobs and Wozniak, that created Apple, before they created their computer, had created a device to cheat Bell out of long-distance phoning. They created a device that allowed you to make a long-distance phone call from a phone booth for free.
This makes me curious about, are there any predictions McLuhan made that have yet to come true but might be on some drawing board somewhere? Or I guess by now it would be a whiteboard, wouldn't it?
I wish I could put my finger on one. I could probably make $1 billion.
Darn, I was hoping for that stock tip.
Right. But of course, once we broadcast this right across the country, someone out there would exploit the idea. In fact, McLuhan once said that the way to solve problems was to go on television and have an audience of 1 million people. And he said one person in that group of 1 million, whether they're educated or not, would come up with a solution to the problem.
So now he invented crowdsourcing too.
Oh yeah, he did invent crowdsourcing for sure.
Looking back now over the years you were working with Marshall McLuhan, do you have any particular favorite memories of that time?
Well, I certainly do. Not long after beginning my collaboration with Marshall, we used to work in the coach house, and we would walk to the cafeteria for our lunch. And so we're walking to the cafeteria, and we're passing by St. Basil's Church on the campus of St. Mike's, St. Michael's College. And Marshall said, Bob, would you mind, I'd like to step into St. Basil's and hear the noon mass. It's only 15 minutes. I'll catch up with you in the lunchroom. I said, oh, Marshall, let me join you. He said, oh, that would be very nice, Bob. So there we were. He was praying for his salvation, and I was praying to understand what he said that morning. Oh, I just thought of another great story. Okay. One more. On the telephone, we began to argue as to whether the Hebrew alphabet or the Semitic alphabet was the first alphabet, or whether it was the Greek alphabet. Marshall claimed it was the Greek alphabet because it had the vowels, which the Hebrew alphabet did not have. And we were arguing over the telephone, and he finally said, Bob, we'll never settle this over the phone. Come on over for lunch. Well, this was my first invitation to his home, and I got very excited. I immediately went home, changed into some clean duds, went to the liquor store, bought a bottle of wine, arrived at his house 30 minutes later, rang the doorbell, and the door flew open, and there was Marshall McLuhan with an apron that had the Hebrew alphabet emblazoned on it. I handed him the bottle of wine, and he said, thank you, and he put it on the mantelpiece, and he said, come into the kitchen. I have lunch prepared for us. And what did he serve me for lunch? He served me a bowl of alphabet soup.
Robert Logan is the author of Understanding New Media, Extending Marshall McLuhan. He spoke with Anstrengchamps.
Global Village is not created by the motor car or even by the airplane. It's created by instant electronic information movement. The Global Village is at once as wide as the planet and as small as a little town where everybody is maliciously engaged in poking his nose into everybody else's business. The Global Village is a world in which you don't necessarily have harmony. You have extreme concern with everybody else's business and much involvement in everybody else's life. It's a sort of Ann Landers column writ large.
It's not hard to draw a parallel between Marshall McLuhan and author Douglas Copeland. Like McLuhan, Copeland is Canadian, and while McLuhan coined such memorable maxims as the medium is the message, Copeland came up with the term Generation X in his 1991 best-selling novel of the same name. And both men are known for their sharp culture-watching skills and prescience about society in the future. Copeland has a new book out. It's called Marshall McLuhan, You Know Nothing of My Work. Copeland's biography isn't your traditional McLuhan biography. It features MapQuest directions and McLuhan's pirate and Mexican wrestler names, courtesy of online name generators. Copeland told Steve Paulson why he wanted to take such an unconventional approach.
I just thought it was interesting to show the manifestation of his ideas, as well as the ideas themselves and how he came about them. By the way, his drag queen name is Vanilla Thunderstorm. So that's where that's coming from. In terms of using MapQuest, when he went moving on up from one house to the house on the hill, why not include directions on how he got there? You know, turn left on Yonge Street, go forward three blocks, that kind of thing. It just seems like, A, it does turn out he was right, but B, I think the larger thing is, okay, then if he's right about this, and he started 2,000 years ago, worked up to the present, and then slightly into the future, he died in 1980, well, he's probably further right. It doesn't end at 2011. It probably goes a lot further ahead. Look at all these new technologies. McLuhan was always saying that they would reinforce tribalism, or they would reinforce community, for everything from people with cystic fibrosis, people with gambling addictions, you name it, there's an online community. But even more largely, you know, does it support secularism, or does it support a theocratic state? And we haven't quite figured that out there. I think we thought it was theocratic state for a while, but then there was the Arab Spring. And so a lot of this stuff's still playing out.
Right. You write about a condition which you call time sickness. Can you explain what this is, time sickness?
There's that old cliche of his, the medium is the message, which Marshall invented or came up with or whatever in the late 50s, early 60s, back when television was new and exciting, and people were sort of paranoid about it. They thought that, you know, because it's electronic, that it crosses the free will membrane that books don't, and that if you saw communism on TV, then you would become communist. And then what he was saying in a broader sense is that what matters isn't what you're watching on TV. What matters is that you're watching TV itself. And I think if you look into the present, forget TV, we've had to absorb about 15 new technologies in about a decade, and they keep coming at us, boom, boom, boom. And what's happening as a result of this is that we know that 99% of what we say in texts and phone messages and emails and everything else is just crap. But the message is that we're doing all this, and it is warping our sense of time, our perception of time.
Is that to say that it's speeding up time, or are you talking about something else?
It's the perception of time. I mean, it's July as we tape this interview right now. Good God, what happened in the first 6 months of the year? I barely remember them happening. And it's not a function of me just being older and 1 year is less, a smaller percentage of your life. We all kind of know it in our heart that we've done something to our perception of time. It's just gone all crazy. And that is the message of all this media we're using. It's just like, wow, we're all these media, like, hi, I'm your cell phone. I'm messing with your sense of time, basically.
Do you think that alarmed McLuhan? I mean, that in a sense we were stepping out of, I guess, what you might call organic or biological time and creating a new kind of time?
I would actually argue that in a weird way all this technology is far more organic because it allows people to manifest their humanity more quickly. I mean, whenever the plane lands at the airport, the first thing every single person in the plane does is, you know, grabs their BlackBerry or their iPhone or what have you. And you have to remember, he was this crusty fuddy-duddy guy in Toronto in the 50s, and he not just didn't like, he hated the 20th century. He hated technology. He thought it was inhumane. He wanted to live like centuries around the time of the Gutenberg press.
How could he hate technology? He was the great prophet of the coming age of technology.
There's your irony for you. Oh no, he was a devout Catholic. For him, all that mattered was the afterlife, and, you know, existence on this plane was sort of a trial or something you had to go through. I mean, in his early life, he came from sort of a very a Canadian prairie Protestant background, sort of like my own, which gave me a little bit of a plus in understanding him. So he was quite at home with endgame theology or the end of days, that kind of thing. So for the world to end or for the world to be a disaster was like, okay, well, that's just, you know, I heard about that when I was young. I'm okay with that. And it's kind of depressing, actually. And he thought that the only thing that was actually going to save human or mankind was natural law,
Was there some connection then between his belief as in the afterlife as a good Catholic and this new technological future he was imagining?
When he was giving his lectures at sort of his peak, it wasn't just students in his own class who would show up. I mean, hundreds of people would show up, celebrities or his people had heard, like, you got to hear this guy talk. And when he spoke in front of a crowd, he would just go off on a tangent almost immediately. And he was his own radio station, and he didn't really take Q&A from the audience or anything like that. And half the people in his class were probably tripping on acid when they were watching him. And he looked at all these kids with their long, greasy hair and their outfits, and he was just disgusted by them. But he never actually said that out loud. He said it elsewhere. No, he just, I don't know what to say here. He didn't like the modern condition, and he saw no hope in it. So what would he think of the internet is my question. He'd probably think it's very, very interesting, but he's probably quite happy to be in heaven right now.
Well, this is so fascinating because you're really describing a man who was, he probably would have rather have not even have lived in the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. I don't know. He probably would have liked to have lived in, I don't know, the 16th century or something like that. And
oh, well, actually, that's pretty bang on. And in a strange way, he got what he wished for. And you have to remember with Marshall, he had an extraordinary brain. He had a number of conditions that we might call mild Asperger's. He was an extraordinary mimic. He had an amazing memory. He had this vein that went from the base of his neck into the left lobe of his brain, which in mammals is a form of blood circulation found only in cats. So he really did have a freakish brain. He had a massive brain tumor removed. I think it was 67.
Wait, so you're saying he had an extra artery going into his brain, like one more than everyone else?
Yes, indeed, into the left lobe of his brain. He's medically extraordinary. And so he had all of these conditions going. And then he had a number of little baby strokes throughout 60s and 70s. Sometimes like he'd be speaking in front of a class and he'd just stop, like freeze for about 60 seconds and then suddenly thaw and go back to where he was. And in the last year of his life, he had a catastrophic stroke. What the stroke did was it removed his ability to formulate words or to read words. And so that if he was sitting in your living room, he would look around him and he would know what everything was, but he couldn't make the name for it in his head, or he couldn't even have an internal dialogue with himself. But if you walked in and said, like, hi, I'm sitting in the chair right now, and like, oh, look at that robin outside in the yard, and he'd know exactly what you were saying. A very, very specific and strange kind of stroke. And it which did return him to a pre-literary era, for better or for worse. And, well, he died in 1980. So, yeah, and be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also fascinating because he was a literary man. I mean, to his toes. He had gone off in the mid-1930s to the University of Cambridge to study with some of the great literary scholars of the day, and he encountered what became known as the New Criticism, the literary movement that emphasized the close reading of literary works. Do you think that kind of literary training helped to shape his later thinking about technology?
You actually might even go a little bit earlier than that. His mother, Elsie, was an elocutionist in the Canadian prairies back in the teens and the 20s. She had this gift, which Marshall received from her genetically, where she could look at something once, memorize it forever, and then do astonishing accents. Marshall, he was apparently a terrible student in school until his mother turned him on to elocution, which is good for her because now she had an elocution buddy in the house and they could talk shop together. And so when he went to Cambridge, everyone thought, oh, here's this yokel from the colonies. And suddenly, like, boom, he's just like, you know, reading the great works of history back with the proper accent or brogue or what have you. And he got a lot of, you know, street cred at Cambridge for that. I think what happened was he saw literature maybe ending with Finnegan's Wake. I think that was sort of the end of literature in a lot of ways, where
James Joyce's great book that no one understands, that this was his favorite book.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it sort of represented the point in history where words stop being words. They just become sound effects, and where sort of language collapses on itself. And he found that fascinating. And I don't think he ever really cared for anything written after that. Again, he was not a 20th century man.
And yet he was, in some ways, the prophet of the late 20th century in terms of the technology that he created.
Yeah, no, it is an irony.
Yeah. Well, you say that he was a master of pattern recognition, and that's to some degree what he looked for when he was reading James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake or going back to the 16th century Reformation pamphleteers. He was looking for the way this stuff fit together.
Well, yeah. He saw the modern world as a maelstrom, and which was trying to pull you and everyone else down into the void. And his thinking was that the only way that you can remain cohesive as an individual or to keep your sense of self intact was to attempt pattern recognition, was to try and find patterns wherever you could. And you might not find them, but the act of searching for patterns will in some way keep you afloat. And it's actually pretty good advice and pretty germane at the moment, I might add.
Douglas Copeland is a writer and artist. He's the author of Marshall McLuhan, You Know Nothing of My Work. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Instead of going out and buying a packaged book, of which there have been 5,000 copies printed, you will go to the telephone, describe your interests, your needs, your problems, and they at once Xerox, with the help of computers from the libraries of the world, all the latest material just for you personally, not as something to be put out on the bookshelf. They send you the package as a direct personal service. This is where we're heading under electronic information conditions.
What do you think Marshall McLuhan got right, and what do you think he got wrong? You can let us know by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll look at how Marshall McLuhan's ideas influenced David Cronenberg's 1983 sci-fi horror film, Videodrome, as we conclude our special salute to Marshall McLuhan on the centenary of his birth. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Marshall McLuhan's ideas have legs. Just ask Carrie Rickey. She's the film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's also the author of the essay Videodrome, Make Mine Cronenberg, which accompanies the Criterion Collection's DVD release of David Cronenberg's 1983 sci-fi horror film Videodrome. The film was inspired by Marshall McLuhan's work. Carrie Rickey gave Steve Paulson a plot summary of Videodrome.
It's about a broadcaster named Max Wren, played by James Woods. He runs a cable channel in Toronto that's always looking for the new cheap thing to broadcast. And he's broadcasting a lot of low-rent porn. One of his technicians tells him about this signal he's getting from Pittsburgh, kind of this phantom show called Videodrome. And it's a kind of S&M scenario with a very weird minimalist set, and James Woods gets hooked on it, as does a radio broadcaster he meets on a talk show played by Debbie Harry, and they kind of bond in bondage while watching Videodrome. But that's only the first
right.
5 minutes.
Yeah, the kind of videos they're watching. I mean, basically, you're watching people get tortured or killed.
Correct. It's torture porn.
And they're getting off on that.
Yes. Or they're getting excited.
Yeah.
Presumably.
So what happens after the first 5 minutes then?
After the first 5 minutes, the James Wood character gets hooked and his body starts mutating. And he meets a lot of shady characters, and it seems that because of his proclivities for pornography, he was chosen to be programmed by evil capitalist forces. And the rest of the movie is about his response to it and his hallucinations from the Videodrome shows he watches. He has hallucinations, his body mutates. And I guess I didn't see this at the time, but in the years since it's been released, I realized it was Cronenberg's satire about the forces who say that pornography and violence make us numb and desensitized. Cronenberg saying, wait, doesn't it do the opposite? Doesn't it sensitize us and make us more vulnerable instead of less? I think it's a very frightening and, shall we say, controversial movie, but it's really asking a basic question. Does media really make us duller and desensitize us? And Cronenberg saying, no, just the opposite.
Hmm. Now, it's worth pointing out that David Cronenberg not only directed Videodrome, he also wrote it, and he has said that he was inspired by Marshall McLuhan, the great media prophet of the day. One of McLuhan's key ideas is we shape our tools, and therefore our tools shape us. Do you see that in Videodrome?
Well, yes, and David Cronenberg was a student at the University of Toronto, I believe, when McLuhan was the oracle there. I don't believe he ever took classes from McLuhan, but I know he read deeply in McLuhan, and I always saw Videodrome as kind of a visual pun on McLuhan's understanding media, the extensions of man, because the James Wood character actually changes physically. His tools, a gun, kind of sutures itself to his hand. He develops, shall we say, an aperture in his abdomen where you can actually put in a videotape. So it seems to me a kind of a visual pun on the extensions of man.
Hmm. And McLuhan himself had rather complicated feelings about the new technological age that he was writing about. I mean, to some degree, he was a great visionary of it, but it wasn't at all clear that he actually liked what was happening.
Max's obsession with media is an illustration of McLuhan's observation that, you know, mental breakdown is the common result of inundation with new media. Max Wren, the James Woods character, does have kind of a mental breakdown with this inundation and the new information.
Now, it would seem that McLuhan's influence is also evident in the character of Brian Oblivion. Can you tell me about him?
Brian Oblivion is a very oracular figure in Videodrome. He is a professor and great thinker who only appears on TV while on TV, meaning he's on remote, seen framed by a television monitor on talk shows and wherever.
The battle for the mind of North America will be fought in the video arena, the Videodrome. The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, the television screen is part of the physical structure of the brain. Therefore, whatever appears on the television screen emerges as raw experience for those who watch it. Therefore, television is reality, and reality is less than television.
You ask, why did this happen in Canada? And I have some theories about that. I think that McLuhan was responding to, and Videodrome is in part about, this country where foreign signals are coming in from America, and they're trying to make sense of them. And you think about Canada, it's a country of, what now, about 35 million people. 75% of the country lives within 100 miles of the 49th parallel, and all those people are getting American signals on their TV.
Hmm.
And I think they're trying to make sense of something that we in the lower 48 or lower 50, however you want to say that, that we don't try to make sense of because it's just part of our natural landscape.
Mm-hmm. And of course, but it's worth pointing out that not only McLuhan was Canadian, but Cronenberg was also Canadian and presumably grew up being bombarded by all this media that came from the United States.
Exactly.
You know, in the essay that you wrote about Cronenberg's film Videodrome, you have a fascinating comment. You describe his films as vividly cerebral and visceral, which would seem to be contradictory, but somehow you're suggesting that these two things feed off of each other.
I think that why I'm so interested in Cronenberg movies is that they make me feel and think at the same time, and not all movies have the ability to do that. Great directors can get you to do that, and I think Cronenberg is one. But while I am incredibly revolted by the image of Max Rand developing this slot in his abdomen where he can insert a videotape or video cassette, I also think, wow, at the same time, how do new media actually mutate us? Is this like a new mutation, like primates going from walking on all fours to standing up? Is it a new mutation to kind of bond with our machines? And of course, you see people really connected to their cell phones and their laptops today. And this kind of human-machine hybrid is kind of the study of social scientists like Donna Haraway, who basically says we've become hybrids with our machines.
We've become cyborgs.
Right, exactly.
Well, McLuhan is typically described as the great visionary of his era, especially when it comes to technology. And I guess the question is whether Cronenberg is also or was also. I mean, it would seem that he was kind of prophetic in the way he was thinking about technology back when he made this in the early 1980s.
Well, he always said that frequently he made movies about science that were totally imaginative, such as They Came From Within, in which doctors use parasites to help diseased organs, and these parasites also help boost sexual function. And after his movie came out, Cronenberg got a letter from some physicians in New York who were indeed doing this very research, and Cronenberg was shocked because this was part of his imagination. But people like Cronenberg and McLuhan had imaginations and could basically see where things might go.
Now, McLuhan died in 1980, so he didn't live long enough to see Videodrome. Any guesses as to what he would have thought of this film?
I think he was capable of great amusement. I think he would have been flattered, and especially because Brian Oblivion has a life after death.
Yeah, as McLuhan seems to have.
Absolutely.
Carrie Rickey is the film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's also the author of the essay Videodrome, Make Mine Cronenberg, which chronicles Marshall McLuhan's influence on David Cronenberg. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 724A, Marshall McLuhan at 100. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Special thanks to special guest engineers Aubrey Ralph and Brittany DeAnda. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Today's engineer is Steve Gotcher.
PRI, Public Radio International.